Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating book, and not only are we going to talk, we're going to hear some wonderful music this hour. Robert Darden is the author of several books on gospel music and sacred music, African-American music. Nothing But Love in God's Water is the name of his latest book, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. He is Associate Professor of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media at Baylor University and is a former gospel music editor for Billboard magazine. He also is working on, this is a wonderful project, the director of the Gospel Music Restoration Project, which is currently at Baylor University. And it's going to become a permanent fixture, feature of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture when it opens on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. We have much to talk about. We'll look at slaves, the singing in the fields as they were working, the fact that they were in some states later on prohibited from singing because somebody figured out that there were secret meanings to the words here. There were elaborate codes. We'll listen to some songs that have been incredibly influential and talk about some performers who sang these songs from their souls in very important commemoration periods here in the United States. We'll look at the union movement and protest songs, the civil rights movement, and all of that with Robert. We also, later in the program, we just heard from his publisher that he wrote a piece which has just appeared on Huffington Post. Evidently, for 20 years, he was senior editor of the world's oldest, largest, and pretty much only religious humor and satire magazine, The Wittenberg Door. It ceased publication after a 40-year run, and he has written about the senseless murder of 12 people in the offices of the French satiric magazine, his response, grief and rage and hate, hatred of the killers who apparently espouse a particular virulent strain of religious radicalism. We'll talk with him about that later in the program. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Robert, thank you so much for being with us and for writing this book. I'm looking forward to the hour.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's great fun to talk about your favorite subject and get paid for it.
I would imagine it is. I feel the same way, only for a lot of subjects. Let's talk about those who came here from Africa, African Americans. They sang, you write, because they sang in Africa, and singing really was a part of their lives and souls. And a lot of there were similarities, even though they were from different countries and different cultures, there were similarities among the subjects or the songs themselves.
That's correct. The Western African people groups, of which, as you said, were fairly diverse, had developed a fairly sophisticated music form hundreds and hundreds of years before they ever showed up in America. And the great distinctives of that form can still be heard very vividly, even today, in most American popular music. But what the Western Africans brought with them was the love of improvisation, the call-and-response format, the absolute authority of the beat playing just a little ahead or just a little behind the beat, the use of music to tell stories and to talk about things long past and make predictions of the future, and a certain what we call double-voicedness, that words could have meanings depending on the listeners and which circle the listener was in. And you can hear every one of those things, including the so-called blue notes, the notes not on the Western pentatonic scale, and all American popular music, with possible exception of country and Western.
And short of physical confrontation, you write, or escape, these songs may have been the first nonviolent protest of an enslaved people.
You would think that for a people that had everything else taken away from them, they carefully put the slaves together so they did know the same language. Their Yoruba were never next to the Igbo, were never next to that. So they destroyed the language. They destroyed the religions they brought with them. They wouldn't allow them to read or write. In fact, in some states, it was punishable by death for the slave and the person who taught them to read or write. punishable. If you had a map, it was punishable for by death for you and your entire family. Most of the states wouldn't even allow you to have shoes. The one thing that survived, and the slave poets very carefully nurtured this, was this music that they brought with them, because they convinced their overseers that they could work better and faster and be happier if they were allowed to sing what their slave owners thought were nonsense songs.
And little did they know that these songs were not nonsense songs, right?
Absolutely. And you could sing the most complicated material right under the noses, literally. As people were standing over you in the cotton fields of Alabama, you could do things like teach your fellows to read or write, to teach them to count, to give them actual very explicit directions how to follow the Tombigbee River up to the Ohio River, how to share your religious faith when Christianity was finally very reluctantly introduced. One of the fascinating things about Western African music is there was never any distinction between the sacred and the profane. Every song was sacred. Every song was also a work song. I guess the best surviving example of that is in a country that had no bridges virtually, and everybody had to be ferried from one side of a river to the other. One of the most popular jobs is to be a do a rowboat. And one of the work songs that was on rowboats, sung by slaves, was "Michael, row your boat to shore." But the next line is "Hallelujah."
Yes. What was interesting, I really found fascinating, the spread of the Christian faith among African Americans, slow as you say it was, but all of a sudden, and this is profound, the teachings of Jesus, you write, systematically eliminated distinctions among believers. Few slaveholders were willing to admit that the creatures they despised were also human. A lot of slaveholders weren't very religious, but all of a sudden, these very powerful, heroic figures who become a part of the music, the stories of Moses, Daniel, and Jesus.
That's an interesting thing, because we think of this being, people at least try to claim that this country was a Christian country from the beginning, but certainly if you read history, you know that's not necessarily the case. And in the Deep South, it's even more so. In fact, most of the extant records show that none of the plantation owners and their workers even went to church. And in some big cities in the South, including Birmingham and others, there were churches that sat empty. But when the Great Awakening occurred and the Quaker missionaries began coming down and they began to force, in whatever way they could, the slave owners to bring a religion to their the slaves, they brought a very perverted, corrupt form of religion, one that emphasized only slave, obey your master. But the slaves are smart. They've come from smart, brilliant people that had their own literature and had their own culture. I mean, the Western Africans had running water and sewer systems and gas lamps before they had it in Western Europe, in some of those states. They figured out by listening outside the churches, listening under the porch when the Bible was discussed, listening as the children were put to bed with Bible stories, what the true message of Christianity was. And they cobbled together from all these little pieces a form of Christianity that a lot of scholars, and I'm one of them, who thinks that is much closer to what the first century church Christians believed than what the Christianity that eventually filtered to America in the 1600s and 1700s. It was a religion based on love and on Jesus and on forgiveness.
That's fascinating. I've come to the point where we simply have to hear some music. This is Go Down Moses. We were talking about Moses and the close association with Harriet Tubman, something we'll explore with Robert in just a moment. This is from the aforementioned Gospel Music Restoration Project, which will be part of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History, and it's being sung, Go Down Moses, Marian Anderson.
Let my
Marian Anderson with Go Down Moses, one of the very, very important earlier songs you mentioned in the book, very associated with Harriet Tubman. Why?
She was called by some of the people in the Underground Railroad General Moses, because like the early Hebrew people, she led hundreds, maybe thousands, we're not really sure, of slaves to freedom using the various stops of call along the Underground Railroad. And it's said that that was one of the songs that she sang when she would come to a plantation to let the people know she was there and what her intentions were. The other one that she is supposed to have sung, and the records are pretty good, that was Wade in the Water, one of my favorites. One of the nice things about Wade in the Water was it taught the slaves how to get away from the bloodhounds that were trailing them. You get in the streams, and you walk that way.
And here's a bit of Wade in the Water.
Wading in the water,
wading in the water.
I love that song as well, and as I listen to it, I'm thinking to myself, I know almost all the words to this. This song has survived for a long, long time.
What's amazing about the spirituals is what we have, and there's about 6,000 known spirituals, according to John Lavelle, is that what we have is just a snapshot of what they sounded like on one night on one plantation. One of the distinctives of the spirituals is they never were sung the same way twice, and that lyrics and words were changed as things needed to be changed. They were kind of a rolling newspaper in that regard. So we'll never know what they, any definitive version of any spiritual. What we have is what was copied one time in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm. I know that one of the books that you wrote looked at laughter in African-American churches. You were visiting them, and you found that it was a bit absent from white churches. Did you find any of this kind of laughter or joy in these early spirituals, or was life too incredibly oppressive that you couldn't sing very much about joy?
Well, there's a little of everything in the old spirituals, and there are some kind of funny spirituals or spirituals that if you kind of know the code and the key to them, you know they're actually making fun of the people that are oppressing them. And that's one of the great things that music can do from a satiric standpoint. It's a multi-use tool. I don't know that the spirituals themselves had a whole lot of humor, but their accompanying work songs, many of those, Jimmy Crack Corn, I Don't Care type songs, many of them had very pointed and very funny comments about the people who owned the plantations. And they were allowed as long as they continued to womp the cane and crack the corn and cut the cotton. And on one day a year, sometimes New Year, sometimes harvest, they were in fact encouraged to sing wittier and wittier songs that made fun of the overseers and the plantation owner. Probably a carryover from some of the Holy Fool celebrations in Europe at the time, where on one day the poor man became Pope and the Pope became a beggar, and they were allowed kind of this April Fool's Day. And it eventually was crushed in the 1800s. But there's some faint resonances of that carried right on through in the South.
So was this the point at which some Southerners sensed that some of the spirituals were not just harmless spirituals and banned their singing?
What was really banned more than the spirituals was the drums. They hated and feared the drums.
The drums?
Yeah.
Huh.
The words in the spirituals, first off, they would intentionally sing them in such a way that, even though the words are very overt to me, if the Lord can deliver, why not any man, to me, sounds about as overt as it can get. And yet we have records of it being sung right in the face of multiple overseers. They were just convinced that these people weren't smart enough to make those kinds of leaps of judgment. But what they did fear was the idea that the drums could call the people together, and they could do. Drums are associated with some of the slave rebellions, Daniel Vesey and some of the others. And so there were states where you might sing anything you want, But if they heard drums out in the woods at night, they'd send an entire posse looking for you.
Robert Jordan is our guest, and the book is Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. We're welcoming phone calls for him as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll hear more music. We'll go to another very, very important piece sung by, in this version, Paul Robeson, John Brown's Body. And we'll have Robert talk about that as we continue. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to hear a little bit of John Brown's Body. Our guest, Robert Darden, writes in his book that this has been popular almost from the second that it emerged from its murky beginnings. Paul Robeson hears this. It has been sung by so many. Joan Baez, Pete Seeger, Van Morrison have all recorded this. We'll talk about why it was popular and how important it was for so long. This is Paul Robeson with John Brown's Body. I'm listening to the drums in a whole different way after you said that about the drums, Robert. what are the murky beginnings of this song?
Boy, I wish I knew. I could make a lot of money trying to think. We know it didn't start being about John Brown, the abolitionist. It was about a John Brown who was a sergeant. I think he was assigned to the 2nd Battalion of the Massachusetts. I think then later went to the 12th. And it was really a joke song. It was based on an old camp meeting tune, Say Brother, Will You Meet Us? And I suspect it's even older than that. That's probably an English folk tune, but I haven't been able to run that down. And it has John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but it was more of a joke. But after the business that happened at Harper's Ferry, and the abolitionists took it over, and everybody loved that kind of martial, dashing kind of beat, it was absorbed into both the Union Army, where many of the bands became famous for playing at probably the most famous of all, the 79th New York Regiment, the so-called Highlanders of the Union, Lincoln's favorite band. That was one of their signature numbers. And it stayed in the slave side as John Brown's Body, as a song that, while not a spiritual, took on protest spiritual elements. And it was sung, it's just about everywhere. It's just ubiquitous. There's a famous account of when Richmond falls and the Union troops march in, black and white. They're singing and playing that, and they're met by all the freed blacks who are lining the roads of this burning city, singing it back at them. Hmm. And it becomes like Dixie did for the South, a song that takes on a greater meanings over and above what it originally started. And then later it's rewritten into the more formal glory battle hymn of the Republic. But it starts off probably as a drinking song.
As a drinking song. Interesting.
Kind of like the Star Spangled Banner in that regard.
What was sung at the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, the signing of that?
Well, that was inside. But to get there and back, Lincoln had to pass through a number of large camps where there were slaves being kept, contrabands, they were called them. John Brown's Body is supposed to be one of the songs that was sung along with, Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then a spiritual I haven't really been able to track down. All we know is the title, Year of Jubilo, and I'm sure at least one account says Go Down Moses.
The staying power of all of this music is fairly remarkable, that we find many of the same songs are also a part of the labor movement. They're part of the civil rights movement. The songs are so associated with important movements in American history. Why?
Well, that's what's taken me two volumes to kind of tease out. Volume one, which goes from before the American Civil War to the Montgomery bus boycott, and then Volume 2, which I just finished last week and will be sending to the publisher in a few weeks, takes it from the sit-in movement and the freedom rides to Resurrection City and the Poor People's Campaign. Throughout those years, throughout those hundreds of years, these songs provide a pool. They provide a pool that people in great need, primarily African Americans, can dip into and pull back out, and it's like some kind of common cultural memory. They come intact with all of the weight of what they've been used for in the past, and the songs are so fluid that lyrics can be changed, because three spirituals were, to be updated whether you're in Birmingham or whether you're in Flint, Michigan. They can be resurrected, and they're being sung, as you probably know, there's pictures of them being sung on the Berlin Wall, at Tiananmen Square, at the Hong Kong Umbrella Revolution. These songs are sung because they work. Whatever it is that you need for them to do, if you sing them with that kind of belief and your cause is just, they have been shown to be sung at every one of those places.
Mm. This has always been one of my favorites, and she's worth a whole book in herself. Sung by the great Mahalia Jackson. You write about her quite a bit.
And I do.
Yeah, let's talk about her and listen just a portion of Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen.
No, nobody knows. No.
The great Mahalia Jackson, and Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen.
I love that too.
I need to get a CD or something of hers. I need to listen to her more often. Oh my gosh.
That's a great example of what we call surge singing. It's
yes.
An old Baptist tradition where the two accompanists, the keyboards players, have no idea where she's going to go. And they're waiting for her to go to the next note. And all they're doing is providing on the seat of their pants, kind of a backing. But she used to give fits in the studio, because once the spirit took Mahalia, she went where she needed to go.
Did she always sing religious songs?
Yep. Never once. We don't have a single example of her singing anything else. And she was tempted many, many times to move into the secular world. And when she signed with Columbia after she was with Apollo Records, a gospel label, they wanted her to do everything. They made her sing some of the worst treacly drivel that had just inspirational, but she would not sing a straight-ahead pop song. And I don't guess she ever really needed to, because her greatest sales and the songs that had the biggest impact, including Moving On Up, which may still be the best-selling gospel song of all time, is straight-ahead gospel.
Mm-hmm. Describe for us, as you do in the book, her being invited to speak by President Kennedy at the centennial celebration of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1963.
Well, she almost didn't do it. Because
really?
There was no black person originally on the program.
Oh.
And only belatedly did they invite Mahalia, and they still weren't going to do it unless some other black people were somehow involved. But she was a confidant and a friend of a number of the great Democrats through the years. She worked for them on their campaigns, toured for them. She said repeatedly that, you know, of people like Franklin Roosevelt and Truman and Kennedy and Johnson, that they fed her when she was hungry, and nobody else would do it but the Democratic Party. So whenever they asked, she sang at the inauguration, she sang at private balls, she sang anytime, just little a cappella things in the Blue Room. Wherever she was asked, Mahalia Jackson closed her eyes, clasped her hands together, and sang as if she was singing in front of a cathedral before 10,000.
Hmm. Absolutely marvelous singer. Let's move into union songs for a moment. The link you write between labor union songs and protest spirituals provides a connection between past and present in the civil rights movement, because many of Martin Luther King's advisors came from the labor movement.
That's
but
right.
It was a difficult alliance at first, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Many of the unions, I'm sorry to say, did not initially allow blacks in them. And some of the few that did, of course, the porters on railroads being the first, but some of the ones, the packing workers and the garment makers and the later UAW, finally did allow African-Americans in. And when they did, they found they inherited a wonderful tradition of singing that could be appropriated to protest lines and work stoppages with the same effect that they had been done on the cotton fields and in the civil rights activities. And very quickly, those songs start blending together, and songs that have been sung by 200 years, beginning in the coal miners in England, carried over to coal miners in Appalachia, become changed and enriched by having this slave sensibility. So some songs change just straightforward. In That Great Getting Up Morning, old slave tune becomes In That Great Union Morning. But other times the change is more subtle, and the ones that kind of blended together, like Which Side Are You On, and my favorite, Like a Tree Planted by the Water, We Shall Not Be Moved, become more powerful for the addition of the spiritual, and are still sung both in labor movements today and civil rights movements today.
And here's some of We Shall Not Be Moved.
By the water, we
shall not be moved. Mavis Staples.
You could play her the rest of the time.
I know. I was
shut up and listen.
I was just thinking I'll play the whole thing, but I can't because I want to hear you speak as well.
I had the great privilege of hearing her a couple weeks ago in San Antonio.
Oh, you did?
Oh, did she wreck the church?
Oh. So tell me how she became prominent, Robert.
Well, the Staples singers were very early supporters of the civil rights movement, and Pop Staples and King were friends from almost the beginning. And a number of one of the groups that wrote very overt freedom-related songs like Freedom Highway and Why Am I Treated So Bad were on their albums, and she sang them. And as one of the last survivors, along with John Lewis of that era, she has continued to sing them along with her other amazing hits and to be a voice for justice even today. Two knee replacements later, she's still hopping on the stage, tearing the walls down.
How old is she now?
I have no idea. I'm guessing late 70s, but I don't know.
Uh-huh. And that song has stayed around for a long time. I hear that being sung at protest marches now.
Mm-hmm. It's a union song probably written in the coal mines. Aunt May or somebody, Ella May or one of those may have actually written it based on something older still. But we first have reference to it in the coal mines.
And did we see more music come from the union movement or from the civil rights? I know they kind of blend together, but were there a whole new series of songs developed during the civil rights movement?
No, not many. The civil rights movement already has this great pool that I mentioned. The side that's enriched is the union side, and they keep more that they didn't have before, and even now being sung. And you may remember the Occupy Wall Street movement. They were singing them, wealthy white kids sitting there in their North Face clothes singing the same songs. It's wherever you need it, it's going to be there. But no, not that many. We Shall Not Be Moved and Which Side Are You On are probably the two main ones.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, I know it's the kind of conversation you're probably listening to, but if you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you this hour. We're listening to a lot of music and talking about Robert Darden's book, It's Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. He is a former gospel music editor for Billboard Magazine, is associate professor of journalism at Baylor University, and he is also directing this marvelous project, the Gospel Music Restoration Project, which is at Baylor now. It's going to be a permanent fixture of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, which will be opening this year, actually, on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., which is a pretty big deal. So join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655. There may be some of these songs that you know all the words to that you think are particularly powerful, or songs that you would like to know the origin of. Robert will be happy to talk about that, as well as the fascinating part of the book, and that's the music that African Americans brought with them and the music that was sung when they were slaves and the messages that the slave owners didn't quite get because they didn't think the slaves were smart enough to have codes in the music, that there was a lot more than what people thought was there. To your phone calls and more conversation and more music in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Jesus said, come unto me, I am the way. Keep your hand on the plow, oh Lord. When my way get dark as night, know the Lord will be my light. Keep your hand on the plow, oh Lord.
Robert Darden is our guest, and his book is Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. That's the great Mahalia Jackson with Hold On. We welcome phone calls, and let's go to Brad in Manitowoc first. Hi, Brad.
Hello. I'd like your guest to comment a little on Sister Rosetta Tharpe and if he would have any music that he could play from her. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, Brad. The Sister Rosetta Tharpe actually predates a lot of the civil rights movement. Her heyday is the 1930s and 40s. But she has one of her big hits. It's one of the, on what they used to call the Harlem radio charts, though, since they didn't have a black version of the Billboard charts in those days. Up above my head, I see music in the air became up above my head, I see freedom in the air. And as it became a hit, it was sung throughout the civil rights movement, and several of her others were picked up because they do have that kind of up-tempo, bouncy beat. Some of them are old Thomas Dorsey tunes, and a few of them are old spirituals.
Hmm. And what about the, you write about Tommy Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson, right?
Well, they start together. She arrives as a teenager from Mississippi in Chicago. I'm sorry, from New Orleans in Chicago. And he's already there and starting to make a living as a gospel songwriter. And he quickly hears her voice and has her stand outside churches. In fact, goes to any kind of religious conference. And he has her sing just a cappella his songs. And many people believe that his songs and her singing is part of what made this version of gospel music dominant in the black religious world even till today. There were several competing types of religious music, Jubilee and others. This is why, from Chicago in the late 1920s and 1930s, it spreads across the country. Those songs, that voice.
Fascinating. You write about to overcome an institution as heinous as perpetual slavery, that there's a call for an equally powerful spirituality, a spiritually compelling heroes. We already talked about Moses' narratives from the Old Testament. It also, it seems to me, calls for a certain kind of rousing. You can feel this music in your soul. It makes you want to get up and clap your hands and become committed to something. What is it about the music, in addition to what they're singing about, that can lend itself to a movement?
Well, a number of factors, and I explore that more fully in Volume 2, but it seems it all gets its start beginning with the slave days through the Great Migration, through the labor movement. Each section adds its own part, and by the time it gets to the Montgomery bus boycott, it's ready to bust out. And what Montgomery adds that hadn't been there before were the mass meetings, sometimes nightly, sometimes three or four nights a week. In Birmingham, they went on for years. And what they do is, probably the most pivotal thing that could possibly happen is you have the power of the black church at the time when the black church was at its most potent influence behind it, the organization of the black church, the financial resources of the black church. You have the religious underpinnings and this almost apostolic succession of the music working. You have these songs that have been honed and shaped into what they were ready to be when they needed to be. And you mentioned clapping, and I think that's a very underrated part of this thing. There's only two spirituals that are sung without clapping. And if you listen to the live recordings on the protest marches and in the mass meetings, every one of them have sometimes very elaborate clapping patterns. And it's hard to stay seated if you're clapping to a beat.
Right.
The only two that don't are We Shall Overcome, which is always sung at the very end with arms crossed, and it's hard to clap when your arms are clasped in front of the person in front of you, and one that was written as a tribute to a fallen pastor in Mississippi. Everything else, the clapping, and once you're clapping, you're involved. And these mass meetings, people would arrive 4, 5, 6 hours ahead of time and sing on their own. And in Birmingham, we have very detailed records. People arrive at 3 o'clock for a 7 o'clock meeting, sing right on up to 7. They'd have about 15 minutes of instruction, maybe a 45-minute sermon, and then they'd last for another 2 hours, and all they did was sing these songs. So something is being accomplished, and some success must be coming for that, or they wouldn't be doing it. And I think it's a combination of all of these factors that culminate with Montgomery bus boycott.
You say that the success of that boycott was one of the most significant catalysts for the civil rights movement. Is there a song? Is there a song that grows out of that bus boycott?
It has fewer than some of the others because, first, there may have been just as many, but it's not as well recorded as later ones. People didn't realize how big the songs were going to be. Bayard Rustin, who was King's right-hand man, who came from the unions and is actually a singer himself, rewrote a version of Give Me That Old-Time Religion, which is considered one of the very first ones where they rewrite an older, that was a camp meeting song rather than a spiritual, but it's used in the same way. And then what we call the gospel trio, three young teenage girls who sang with them throughout, take a few with them to the other movement places along the way, and Hold On is one of them. Walk Together Children, which is particularly apt for all that. Move On Up a Little Higher is sung a lot. Cleopatra Kennedy makes that famous. And Keep Your Eyes on the Prize, Hold On.
Yeah, you mentioned Bayard Rustin. There's a biography of him that has recently been written, and we're going to talk about his life. It just seems appropriate to mention it now, next Thursday at 2 o'clock. We need to play, well, let me just play it, and then you can tell me where this song came from. Everybody knows the words to this. We're talking this hour with the author of Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. This will be familiar to all of you. We'll hear about the origins and how it was performed during various movements with our guest, Robert Darden. This particular selection is from the Gospel Music Restoration Project, and Robert says that it is one of the very earliest recorded versions of the movement's hymn, and you can hear the magisterial aspects here. We probably think of it more associated with Pete Seeger, but it's earlier than that. What are the origins of this song? And tell me more about the people who are singing it now, Robert.
Well, it is, along with Precious Lord Take My Hand, pretty much the anthem of African-American churches. It's sung at every funeral that I've ever been to and every one I've ever seen. It has kind of another one with murky origins. It's based on a black gospel hymn, although the music isn't the same as it, but those lines, We Will Overcome. It starts being used in a protest way somewhere around the 1930s in the tobacco fields where the protests begin there. It goes to Highlander, that amazing school in Tennessee that brings black and white together and teaches poor blacks and whites how to protest and how to stand up for themselves. And very quickly, Highlander becomes kind of a central hub for song dissemination. Besides Pete Seeger, the guy in Candy Carawan, mm-hmm, are probably the two people most responsible for taking what will become We Shall Overcome. And Pete's the one that changes will to shall. And to the different movement sites, when King hears it for the first time in the 1950s, he turns to the people he's with and says, boy, that song really sticks with you, doesn't it? He's never heard it before, and he'll hear it 10,000
right
times before he's gone. And it becomes, and I'm not really sure why that particular song. It's been fascinating to play the recordings back from the 1950s right up until 1968, how it changes and gets some of that Stax Volt funkiness to it near the end with a really pronounced beat, whereas in the beginning it was sung more like a church anthem. but it contains within it, I think, many of the elements that make this music special. It's definitely religious. It's written in such a way that you can change the words to fit whatever situation you're in. And finally, those lines, I do believe, and you have to keep saying that, because if you don't believe, this whole thing's going to fall apart. I do believe that we're going to overcome this someday. Black and white together, I do believe we shall overcome someday. And it's one of those things that if you're a religious person, you have to believe it's a God thing.
So tell me, we don't have a whole lot of time left, about this gospel music restoration project. What's at Baylor now? What's going to be on the National Mall?
Well, the Baylor, we started about 8 years ago, after I'd finished that first book, People Get Ready, A New History of Black Gospel Music, and discovered about 75% of the music I was writing about was lost. You can't buy it. You can't steal it. And so I got together with some collectors and came up with that figure, and I sat down and wrote an editorial that I sent to the New York Times saying that we're going to be judged by future generations very harshly if we let the music that's the foundation of music of all American popular music disappear. And a wonderful gentleman in New York, Charles Royce, said, you figure out how to do it, and I'll pay for it. And he sent us a check for $350,000, and we built the world's greatest restoration studio. So no matter how bad the vinyl is and how old it is, and that we can get an extraordinary digital copy out of it.
Wonderful.
And we'll pay for shipping. We'll pay for insurance. I don't really want to own the black vinyl. What I want to do is harvest the music that's on it to make sure no song is ever lost. And I haven't kept up. I'm just the kind of the face of it. We have technicians who know what they're doing, and they don't let me touch any of the toys back there because I break things. But we have tens of thousands of songs that we've digitized, cataloged, and someday, depending on how the copyright laws shake out, we'd like to make available once again songs that haven't been heard in 60 years.
And what is your newest book? Tell me, you've done three books here. What did you start with? When did you move to? We've talked about what you've done now, and where are you going?
Okay. Well, the one, actually, I've done 25 books, but the ones that matter to me was People Get Ready, A New History of Black Gospel Music in 2005, Reluctant Prophets and Clueless Disciples, using the Bible, using the stories of the Bible and reimagining them, Jesus Laughed, The Redemptive Power of Humor, and then the one that's taken me the last 8 years, Nothing But Love in God's Water, and the title's taken from an old spiritual, Volume 1. And I've been on research leave for the last 6 months to finish Volume 2, which will take it. And I like to take a long nap after all of that and get to go and listen to some more of the music that arrives every day that I don't get to hear for a long time and see where we are and what's going to happen. And we don't know how the Smithsonian is going to use this music, except for that in the new wing there's going to be a place that people will be able to hear, millions of people will be able to hear the music that just a few years ago was lost.
Well, I can imagine music being in every room of that new museum. It would be a good thing. Robert, thank you very much for being with us. What a wonderful contribution to America. And thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest is Robert Darden. His book is Nothing But Love in God's Water, Black Sacred Music from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. He is a former gospel music editor for Billboard Magazine, associate professor of journalism, public relations, and new media at Baylor University. And as we discovered just a little while ago, he was senior editor for 20 years of the world's oldest, largest, and pretty much only religious humor and satire magazine, The Wittenberg Door. We direct your attention to a post of his, which is currently on the Huffington Post in the wake of Charlie Hebdo, Why Satire Matters. Thought we'd go out with some spiritual music, because why not? This is a great day coming. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour and for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios as well.